shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com.
If you're a maintenance supervisor for a commercial property, you've had to deal with everything from leaky faucets to flickering light bulbs. But nothing's worse than that ancient boiler that's lived in the building since the day it was built, 50 years ago. It's enough to make anyone lose their cool. That's where Grainger comes in. With industrial-grade products and dependable fast delivery, Grainger can help with any challenge, from worn-out components to everyday necessities. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Before this episode gets started, I want to give a special shout-out to Dex, who was instrumental in me remaking this particular case and fully expanding it the way that I have. So yeah, these episodes are dedicated to Dex. Thank you, Dex.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Part 1. The Knock. May 25th, 1924. Nathan Leopold wakes at 7:15 a.m. He starts going about his usual routine. He takes his usual cold bath. Most don't bathe daily during the 1920s. But Nathan does. He despises being unclean. He shaves and then dresses for the day. During his breakfast, Nathan reads the morning paper. Police have found what they believe to be the murder weapon. Nathan is beginning to feel a resignation to what the police discover. He read the paper without his heart rate increasing. The bloody chisel found by a night watchman. Police are confused by the tape wrapped on the handle and don't recognize it. Nathan recalls that it's zinc oxide tape, used for wound dressing. He saw his brother using it one day. When preparing for the murder, Nathan applied it to the sharp end of the chisel. The idea was that the zinc oxide tape would prevent cuts and reduce blood spatter. This did not go to plan. The sharp end broke through the tape as the chisel met skull. Bobby Franks was both bludgeoned and stabbed. Nathan remembers this, along with the unsuccessful cleanup. The paper reported that the police were looking for the location where the murder weapon was purchased. Nathan knew it was from the hardware store between 45th and 46th, on Cottage Grove Avenue. He and Richard purchased the chisel a few days prior for 75 cents. Police found the glasses. They were currently seeking the doctor who prescribed them. That would be Emile Douche, located on 30 North Michigan. A loud knock startled Nathan. Is it that time? Already? He opens the front door and is greeted by the police. The police have questions about a class Nathan held near the location where Bobby's body had been found. The police ask Nathan if he can come in for routine questions. The state coroner finds that, though there were cuts to the bone and that his skull had been fractured, it isn't clear if Bobby died from the blows or suffocation. Bobby's face has a discolored copper look, from the hydrochloric acid and discoloration from his windpipe to his right lung. Nathan is questioned for 2 hours. He tells police that he often visits Wolf Lake. The weekend before Bobby Frank's death, he was hunting birds. Nathan is in question about the glasses. He leaves the police station more confident than he felt. Reading the paper that morning, Nathan meets with Richard to break the good news. He tells him everything that happened that morning, from the paper to the police interview. They both agree they must be in the clear. And by God, they have done it. They have committed the perfect crime. To celebrate, Nathan applies to Harvard Law. He is held off, not admitting to himself that there would have been no point of applying had he faced prison. One person considered a suspect is Mott Kirk Mitchell, the professor Nathan spoke with and ran from several nights ago. These seeds are planted by Nathan. And why, you ask, listener? Nathan, being a gay man himself, knows Mitchell's secret. Besides this, many of Mr. Mitchell's colleagues consider his gestures and behavior to be feminine. In 1924, there wasn't a positive outlook for gay men. On May 28th, Nathan speaks with his law professor, Ernst Puckhammer, and further implicates Mr. Mitchell in this suspicion. He tells Puckhammer that it is known amongst students that Mr. Mitchell liked to solicit young male students. This is all a part of Nathan's plan. In his mind, the best way to assure that he's not arrested for murder is to have someone innocent take the fall. It wasn't personal for Nathan. In fact, he always enjoyed Mr. Mitchell's company. Leopold chalked it up to bad luck for the professor. He made an easy target. The rumors about Mott Kirk Mitchell spiral out of control, and he is brought in and questioned for hours. Mitchell explains over and over that he had been home the night of the murder, that there was a group of friends he entertained that night that would gladly back his alibi. Police search the sewers around Mitchell's home. They believe there's a chance that they will find Bobby Frank's clothes. Another teacher is implicated named Walter Wilson. Mr. Mitchell's alibi didn't help release the teacher from custody. It only implicated a colleague. A habeas corpus hearing is held. Both teachers are legally allowed to leave police custody. Instead, they agree to be detained for another 24 hours. Both men are eager to prove their innocence. There's a chance that if they return home now, their social and professional lives are over. Samuel Edelson, the Franks family lawyer, is quoted giving a theory about how the instructors could be guilty. Quote, Mott Mitchell wrote the letter and the text proves it. He's a cultured man. A cultured man with perverted tendencies. Walter Wilson committed the actual crime. Unlike Mitchell, he is a man who needs money. He doesn't own his home, so he has a mercenary motive. On May 29th, there was another knock at the Leopold residence. It's early in the morning, and the police asked to speak with Nathan again. This frustrates Nathan. He finds the Bobby Franks incident a simple distraction at this point. He has law school to worry about. At the door, he asked the police sergeant, Frank Johnson, if he really needs to go all the way down to the station. In the process of explaining that he has already been questioned, Nathan is cut off mid-sentence. Do you wear glasses, Nathan? This stops Nathan cold. His demeanor shifts. Yes, I do. Did you lose your glasses, Nathan? No. Can I see them now? No. I'm going to need you to come down to the station, Nathan. I have an appointment. You'll have to miss it. Nathan joins the detective, but brings along his older brother Michael, the one he saw with the zinc oxide tape before. Leaving for the police station, Nathan stops to call his school and cancel his classes for the day. Three more detectives greet Nathan at their black vehicle. At the police station, Nathan is brought to a special suite. Are these glasses yours? No. Do they look like yours? Nathan admits that they do. In fact, he admits, if his glasses weren't at home, he'd have to admit they were his. The questioning goes on for hours. Nathan is questioned about his former instructor, Mr. Mitchell. When asked if he heard rumors about Mott Mitchell being a homosexual, Nathan denies ever hearing such a thing. Things aren't going as well this interrogation. To Nathan, it appears that he has become a prime suspect. Just before 6 p.m., Nathan's interrogators tell Nathan he's going home. I am? He responds in disbelief. They want Nathan to find his glasses, and the investigators want to be there. At the Leopold residence, Nathan makes a show of looking for the glasses. He isn't a natural actor. He pulls apart furniture with exaggerated frustration. The detectives ask if they can help look. Nathan can't see why not. After a half-hearted effort of searching, the lead detective comes to a sudden stop. Like Nathan, he isn't a good actor. That's fine with Mike. He doesn't care what Nathan believes. You know, Nathan, I just had a thought. And that is? You go out to Wolf Lake to hunt birds all the time, right? Yes. You know, what if you dropped the glasses on one of your trips? One of these birding escapades? This thought hadn't occurred to Nathan. Why, yes, I suppose that's possible. Nathan, what if you accidentally dropped the glasses near the body? A mistake. Nathan admits that makes sense, with an unmistakable excitement in his voice. This could be his way out. Look. Sergeant Mike Johnson turns and walks towards his prey. Nathan, I want you to take a good look at these glasses. A good, long look. You're not in any trouble here, Nathan. This is likely an error of sorts. You probably just dropped the glasses while out birding, maybe with some friends. But what I want you to do is take a good, hard, long look, a good look, and tell me the truth, that these are your glasses, Nathan. They're yours. Nathan's eyes dart around. He can feel the walls closing in on him. The noose slipped around his neck. He swallows. But before he can speak, Johnson cuts him off. Now don't lie to me, Nathan, the sergeant says while rubbing the back of his neck. I don't like liars. You know, we have some people down at the station. Let me tell you, they work magic. They can go over to your eye doctor, and there are these little parts used for eyeglasses, just like these. Little parts for these high-caliber specs. These aren't any old eyeglasses, Nathan. These have imported parts. Do you understand? Nathan stares eye to eye with the sergeant. The man is close enough now for Leopold to smell his breath. Nathan blurts out, I must have dropped them. Out at Wolf Lake. Did you? Johnson responds with a grin. Yes, it must have happened when I was out with my friends. In that moment, it became happy days for Sergeant Mike Johnson. Nathan Leopold just admitted to ownership of the glasses. And those glasses placed Nathan at the location of the body. Part 2. End game. Police escort Nathan back to the station. Investigators stay behind to search Nathan's room. They find a .32 caliber handgun. Nathan never applied for a permit, meaning that he illegally owned this weapon. After that, a letter to Richard Loeb is found. In the letter, Nathan expresses dissatisfaction with Richard's actions. He has become displeased with Richard, going as far as to threaten to kill him. Before the letter ends, Nathan begs to continue his friendship with Loeb. The final section of the letter reads, "Extreme care must be used. The motive of a falling out of cocksuckers would be sure to be unpopular, which is patently undesirable, and forms an unknown but unavoidable bond between us." Nathan has an alibi the day of the murder. He claims he picked up Richard Loeb, and the two drove the loop shortly before having lunch together. After he went to hunt Heron near Lincoln Park, Richard, in his interrogation, explains that he wasn't interested in hunting herons, but tagged along to drink and hang out. When the hunting came to a close, all parties involved weren't drunk, but slightly buzzed. Richard couldn't be taken home as his father was an adamant supporter of prohibition. Instead, they went for dinner at the Coconut Grove restaurant. After dinner, the pair drove around looking for girls. Nathan claims that after finding a couple girls, they took them to Jackson Park. They parked and had some drinks, but didn't get along well with the girls. So, after sending them walking, Leopold and Loeb headed home. Wait a minute. You sent them walking? Yes, responds Nathan. And they just walked home, They just walked home. And what were these girls' names? Edna and May? Nathan responds with a face as calm as stone. The investigators press on and on. They ask Nathan if he has a typewriter. He has a Hammond. The interviewers point out that the letter uses legal terms one might learn from law school. Nathan agrees it's an interesting point. They ask Nathan if he believes in God. No, Nathan replies. When you die, your ashes return to ashes and dust to dust. There is no life after death. No hope of reward or threat of punishment. There is no difference between the death of a man and the death of a dog. It's all the same. I felt that way since I turned 11 years old. The detectives are not impressed. All right, smart guy. Do you know who Sappho was? Yes, responds Leopold. A Greek writer of old. A homosexualist. A pervert, offers the detective. A pervert. Nathan doesn't know the point of this. Okay, he responds. The detective eyes Nathan. Gets in close. Do you know Oscar Wilde? Yes, Nathan replies. I suppose that you're going to tell me he's a pervert. The detective gets right into Nathan's face this time. A cocksucker. Richard Loeb is held in a separate room. He's being questioned, of course. It's not an exciting interrogation. But one thing does matter. The two have conflicting stories. And all of their self-envisioned intelligence, our two supermen didn't bother to get their story straight. According to Richard, he left Nathan after dinner the night of the murder. Nothing in his story contained cruising or picking up two girls. After the interrogations are over, at around 4 a.m., the two spend the night in separate cells. The next day, they are further questioned. Afterwards, they are allowed to have dinners with their families. Nathan speaks to the press. He rails off a few of his favorite authors, mentioning Nietzsche, of course, and his dislike for Socrates. Nathan admits to being an atheist, but denies being a communist. On atheism, Nathan states that belief in God is intended for common people, not supermen like himself. Leopold, Loeb, and their family have shown nothing but confidence to the press. Nathan and Richard don't request a lawyer. When the pair return for questioning, detectives start doing everything in their power to get a confession fast. Police know that once lawyers are involved, things will become exponentially more complicated. Piece by piece, detectives outline how much evidence is stacked against Richard and Nathan. The glasses place Nathan at the location of the body. Nathan's handwriting on his homework matches that of the address on the ransom letter. Nathan's aunt confides to investigators that there has been a different typewriter in the home. She remembers seeing it 2 weeks ago. Sven England, the family chauffeur, dismantles the boy's alibi. He explains to investigators that he spent the night of the murder repairing a squeaky brake on Nathan's Red Willis Knight. The chauffeur also has a lot to say about buckets of red water, and Nathan and Richard spending an entire night scrubbing a vehicle down without his aid. Listener, and who is it that you think breaks? Is it Nathan, who spent the entirety of the crime disembodied, pale, and sweating? No. In dealing with police, he remains stone-faced and confident, unwilling to budge an inch during 36 hours of interrogation. Listener, it being the holidays, sometimes my finances can take a hit. There have been times where I've had to borrow money that took a while to recover from financially, and we've all been there, spending more than we should during the holidays. Take control of your finances by using a Chime checking account with features like no monthly or maintenance fees, fee-free overdraft up to $200, or getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit. Learn more at chime.com/obscura. I've had times during the holidays where it's gone as far to where I've overdrafted, but if I was with Chime, they would have allowed me to overdraft up to $200 with no fees. Join millions of Chime members who are working on financial progress Get spotted on debit card purchases and cash withdrawal. No monthly fees or maintenance fees, and over 50,000 fee-free ATMs. To date, Chime has spotted members over $32 billion in transactions through SpotMe. Friends give friends a boost. Eligible members get complimentary boosts to temporarily increase friends' SpotMe limit. When you give a boost, they can boost you back to temporarily raise your limit. Here's how it works. Set up direct deposit in your Chime account. After a qualifying direct deposit of $200 plus, Chime will notify you to enroll in SpotMe. With an activated debit card, Chime will spot you up to $200 on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. Your next direct deposit is applied to your negative balance. Chime never charges overdraft fees for using SpotMe. Enjoy the holidays while keeping your financial goals on track with Chime. Open your account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank, N.A., or Stride Bank, N.A., members FDIC. SpotMe eligibility requirement and overdraft fee limits apply. Direct deposit timing depends on submission of payment file. Boosts are available to eligible Chime members enrolled in SpotMe and are subject to monthly limits. Fees apply at out-of-network ATMs and for OTC withdrawals.
Save big on your Thanksgiving feast, all in the Kroger app. Buy two, get three free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up with your card. Then get a juicy frozen grade A Kroger turkey for 49 cents a pound, limit one with a $25 additional purchase with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
No, listener, it's Richard who breaks that night. He looks like a disheveled mess, his hair soaked and clinging to his forehead, his eyes nervously darting around, wide and shocked, our criminal mastermind shaking and rocking in his chair. Detectives take turns dismantling every excuse Richard has. They compare and contrast he and Nathan's stories, and how they don't match. Anytime Richard provides an update of a previous told story, the detectives offer to get an update from Nathan. Richard looks sick, his skin flushed of color. He continues to rock in his chair. His eyes are strained red. He knows his back is against the wall. Richard sits up straight and stares at his hands. Why do they always shake? He wipes the tears from his eyes. Then the words come out. I will tell you all. Part 3. A Friendship. Richard Loeb gives a confession. He implicates himself as accessory to the crime. Richard claims he is the one that had driven the rental car, while Nathan murdered the boy. He also claims he wasn't part of the planning phase. After finding out that Richard broke, Nathan's confession follows. His confession is the real deal. Leopold feels both defeated and heartbroken by Richard's betrayal. And with that, the two supermen were caught. The crime of the century became the trial of the century. Richard Loeb's family hired a high-profile lawyer, Clarence Darrow, for $70,000. Adjusted for inflation, that's over $1 million. Darrow refused to allow the boys to claim insanity. He knew that wouldn't go well, so he insisted that they admit their guilt and instead seek mercy. Darrow felt anything else would lead to the death penalty. Hundreds of witnesses were questioned. Nathan Leopold's sexual abuse as a child was explored. Darrow hammered home that Nathan Leopold was subservient to Richard, argued Nathan was just along for the ride. During their time in prison, Richard and Nathan could have been afforded niceties due to their financial class, things like special meals brought from their family, but their lawyer suggested it would look bad on the two. Even then, they were allowed visits from girls. On one occasion, the entirety of the Chicago Cubs came to visit Leopold and Loeb. The team spent time with them, talking and giving them baseball tips. The two were celebrities. Richard Loeb had finally fulfilled his fantasy. The trial ran for 36 days and fully captured the attention of Chicagoans. Reporters twisted any misspoken word into a front-page article, damning the pair as both pampered and evil. Darrow gave a 12-hour-long speech, and for obvious reasons, it will not be read here. It's considered Darrow's most masterful speech of his career. On September 10th, 12 days after the trial, are sentenced to life imprisonment for murder and 99 years for kidnapping. This is a clear victory for Richard and Nathan. This is a clear victory, as both were expected to receive the death penalty. Their lawyer, Darrow, always quick on his feet, when asked what he thought about the verdict, he explained it was what they asked for, but still too harsh. Nathan Leopold Sr. left the courtroom in distress. Jacob Loeb stayed to talk to reporters and explained that his family was shaken to the core. His son would spend the rest of his life in prison. Robert Crowe, the lawyer for the state, is furious by the decision. Richard and Nathan never expressed regret or remorse for the murder. He felt the boys were given a special pass due to their financial class and celebrity. Robert Crowe reminded himself that at least Leopold and Loeb would never see parole. In their cell, Richard began the celebration. He sent Sheriff Peter Hoffman to get he and Nathan extra thick steaks, smothered in onions and every side dish the restaurant had available. Before the sheriff could leave, Nathan stopped him and requested eclairs. Leopold and Loeb were transferred to Joliet Prison. Their heads were shaved, they were given denim jackets and pants, and straw beds on hard concrete. Nathan and Richard were kept on opposite sides of the penitentiary. Nathan on the east wing, Richard on the west wing. The prison is an old one, built in 1858, not seeing any renovations in some years. It held no warmth in the winter, and the heat is unbearable in the summer. Leopold requests and is granted a transfer from the prison. The weather conditions were not to his liking, and the guards treated him poorly. He is transferred to Statesville Prison. Though the guards were less strict there, this created a prison atmosphere of corruption. Gangs run the place, and young prisoners are forced to perform sexual favors. Hidden away were whiskey stills and marijuana plants. It takes Richard 6 years to get a transfer after Nathan's. The two remained in correspondence with each other all that time. Taking time to savor each letter, Nathan read each missive repeatedly before finally putting a new letter away for safekeeping. Eventually, Richard is granted that transfer. Leopold meets once again, and in private, out from under the staring eyes of guards and other prisoners, they embrace and cry. Time spent in this new prison has a unique toll on Nathan. To survive, he could not be a model prisoner. He's placed in solitary confinement on several occasions. And Richard is a quick learner, understanding that the rules of the game has changed since his last prison. Leopold and Loeb become known for their grand schemes, and sometimes they paid for their reputation with prison beatings by guards or prisoners. But the two had each other. They cherished that friendship. They were willing to endure the bruises. One scheme involves a man named James Day. James is in the process of serving a 10-year sentence for armed robbery. He's a small man at 5'5" and weighs only 135 pounds. James' father left when he was a baby, and his mother died when he was young. James is angry with the world. His small frame is misleading. He's a stick of dynamite, ready to explode. When James arrives at the prison, Richard soon sees an easy mark. James isn't the brightest, and Richard takes pleasure in the manipulation. Richard, being educated, works in the prison office building, a highly sought-after job. He suggests to James that he can get James an early parole hearing, on one condition. James provides sexual favors for him and Nathan. January 28th, 1936. Richard Loeb is 30 years of age. James Day attacks Loeb in the shower with a barber's razor. The slashes are numerous. 56 deep gashes before Richard hits the floor. James storms out of the showers, and Richard collapses. In the prison's emergency room, Richard lay on the operating table. The doctors do their best to save him, but the cuts were too numerous. Nathan watches from a small distance, helplessly, as his friend and lover slowly dies. When the surgeons finish, the guards pat Nathan on the shoulder. Without a word, they leave Leopold alone with his now deceased friend, lover, and partner in crime. Nathan takes time slowly washing off the blood of Richard's body. The water eventually stops running red. Nathan breaks down and cries. He cradles Richard's head in his arms. Leopold and Loeb no longer travel that same dark road together. They are now separated by eternity. At James Day's trial, Nathan doesn't contradict Day's story. Something in Nathan has changed. He could have pulled strings to have James given the death penalty, but Richard was gone forever. There wasn't a point anymore. Not in death. Nathan had seen enough. Part 4. Remorse. Nathan became a model prisoner. He learned 27 languages. Nathan used his clerical abilities to improve prison conditions. A library saw a complete overhaul under Nathan's hand. He volunteered to be given malaria. This was to help doctors find better treatment. The doctors told Nathan that they couldn't promise he'd live through the experience. Leopold said that was okay. Meyer Levin, one of Nathan's forever classmates, took advantage of Nathan's newfound friendliness. After getting as much out of Nathan as he could about the Bobby Frank story, Levin wrote a fictional account called Compulsion that is a retelling with the names changed. The novel had a strong influence on Truman Capote and Norman Mailer. Nathan Leopold is revolted by the book. He felt physically sick when reading it. In response, he wrote his own autobiography called Life Plus 99 Years. In his later years, Nathan experienced a great deal of remorse. Using his law skills to help prisoners he felt didn't deserve their strong sentences. Leopold was quick to make friends and was considered a giving person. Never unwilling to use his outside financial connections to make a fellow prisoner's life better. In his book, he had this to say about the development of his empathy. Looking back from the vantage point of today, I cannot understand how my mind worked then, for I can recall no feeling then of remorse. Remorse did not come until later. Much later, I admit. It did not begin to develop until I had been in prison for several years. It did not reach its full flood for perhaps 10 years. Since then, for the past quarter century, remorse has been my constant companion. It is never out of my mind. Sometimes it overwhelms me completely, to the extent that I cannot think of anything else. And on if he had faced sufficient punishment. I've spent 32 years here. Is that sufficient punishment for what I did? I don't know the answer to that, because I don't know how to measure punishment. I know that I have lost those near and dear to me while I've been here. My father, my aunt, who was a second mother to me, my brother. I know that I have forfeited any chance of amounting to anything. I forfeited any chance for happiness. I forfeited a chance for a family. Whether this is sufficient, I don't know. That's for the public to decide. That's for the family of Bobby Franks to decide. I cannot be my own judge. I cannot grant myself forgiveness. After serving 33 years, Nathan is granted parole. After prison, he attempts to use the royalties from his book to create the Leopold Foundation. It is intended as a charity youth center to aid mentally handicapped and delinquent children. The state of Illinois stopped the creation of the charity. Realizing his name is rightfully tarnished in Illinois, Nathan Leopold moves to Puerto Rico, where he meets a widow named Trudy Feldman Garcia de Cuevado. They're at a small party of intellectuals. She is charmed by Nathan and finds him both sweet and sensitive, but she also found him to be deeply troubled, lacking in peace of mind. Nathan seems to live a life of constant resentment of himself and his past actions. The two don't speak for months. 3 months after first meeting, Trudy sends Nathan a card with carefully considered text. It reads, "Nathan, I wish to know you, but more than that, I wish you peace of mind." This is something that Nathan desperately wanted, peace of mind. This card strikes a chord with him. There was no response for some time, but then, one day, Trudy receives a large delivery of flowers from a local shop. Nathan meets with Trudy and asks if she wants to aid in his fundraising efforts for a local charity he established. At first, this is what their relationship is. Nathan runs the charity and Trudy helps with the tasks, such as handing out pamphlets. With time, Nathan and Trudy begin to see each other outside of charity activities. They have frequent lunches together. They arrive together for small parties. When asked by a friend if he's going to marry the widow Trudy, Nathan responds, "She has been very kind and helpful to me. She may have romantic ideas, but surely I haven't. I have loved in this life, but that person is gone now." In October of that year, newspapers run articles with rumors that Leopold and Trudy were engaged. In a letter to another friend, Nathan cleared up the rumors and had this to say, "Trudy is the one who has found each of my successive apartments here in San Juan for me. And generally, she takes care of me to no end. Comes out and cooks me a meal and cleans up the apartment every so often, for instance. There's nothing that girl can't do, from fixing the plumbing to repairing window openers. I eat at her home several times a week, and we see a very great deal of each other. Indeed, this school year, since August, I have hardly gone out with anyone else but Trudy. Last Sunday, for instance, we took a day-long trip to an island together. But all this is a far cry from marriage. For Nathan's 56th birthday, Trudy threw a surprise birthday bash for him. 40 guests arrived. The guests were all in costume, and Trudy even dressed up Nathan's dog. The party went on for hours, not letting out till 3 a.m. in the morning. On February 5th, 1961, Nathan and Trudy married in private. The two drove to a secluded area and had a small ceremony with only a handful of guests. Despite the desire for privacy, the news of the wedding broke 2 days later. Trudy and Nathan moved into her apartment together straight away. The need for privacy was over, everyone knew. The congratulations poured in, and the gossip commenced. Things were happy for a time. Then the problems started. Nathan was impotent when it came to women. He couldn't sexually please Trudy. This is something I assume he knew when he was putting off the wedding for so long. Behind her back, Nathan had sexual relations with young men in their 20s and 30s. In fact, Nathan became a known figure at the local gay bar, even becoming a badge of honor for some young gay men due to Nathan's murderous past. As the years passed, Trudy spent more and more of her time alone. Nathan would go on vacations with young men, disguised as business trips. The vacations would be at beautiful hotels in remote areas of Puerto Rico. While Nathan spent his time relaxing on a beach with a new young boy, Trudy spent that time home alone. Leopold and Trudy never divorced, but as the decades passed, they were together in marriage only. There was a moment they had together. When they were on a small vacation together, Trudy had an argument and brought up the boys. And, according to a letter later written to another friend, something changed in Nathan's eyes. There was a darkness there. He didn't get physical, but something was there. So, eventually, they stopped living together. They stopped seeing each other. Nathan Leopold spent his later years working in a laboratory. He earned a master's degree. Nathan taught classes and became a researcher for a social service program, where he helped research leprosy. His fascination for birds continued, and he spent his free time researching various birds. He published a book on the birds of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. Nathan Leopold intended to write a second autobiography about his post-prison life. There wasn't a night where he didn't think of the murders and the damage it caused to all the families involved. The book never came to be. Nathan died from a heart attack on August 29, 1971, at the age of 66.
Shop the best Black Friday weekend deals up to 70% off only at Tanger Outlets. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Coach, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and hundreds more. Find something for everyone on your list during our biggest sale of the year. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Stores open at 6 a.m. Black Friday. Get your savings at Tanger.com.